Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. We also want to let you know that you can now join our Patreon program. It starts from £5 a month to £10 or £20, depending on what you want. Each tier allows you slightly different levels of access. Depending on which one you choose, you can enjoy early access to podcast episodes, exclusive member benefits, merchandise, shout outs, and your chance to feature on one of our shows. Any support you can give us is massively appreciated and will help us grow and continue to bring cool content to race fans all over the world. You can find the link on our socials, just search for Motormouth or go to patreon.com. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and you can also leave us a review. Download the Motormouth app where you can get live race times, exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy.
Welcome to episode 18 of the Motormouth podcast. Alongside me, but down in Essex, as always, is thespian motorsport guru and bearded beauty, Harry Benjamin. Good evening, Harry.
Good evening to Tim. How are you? Dealing with what day are we on of isolation now? Can't recall.
I have no idea. It feels like about 100, to be honest with you. I've completely had enough of it. And maybe by the time this gets released, we'll all be down the pub. But I have a feeling we could be doing this for quite some time.
I just can't wait for the pub session after this is all over. That's going to be a fun one.
Shall I introduce today's guest? So today we are joined by a man who's currently 11,000 miles away in the lovely country of New Zealand. In recent times, our guest, Brendan Hartley, has competed in European Le Mans, Bathurst 12 Hours, the 12 Hours of Daytona, the 24 Hours of Le Mans as part of the World Endurance Championship with Porsche in the 919 Hybrid alongside Timo Bernhard, an Antipodean colleague and friend Mark Webber. He would go on to not only several podiums but the overall championship not once but twice, winning the 24 Hours of Le Mans along the way. Porsche left endurance racing at the end of 2017, and Brendan found himself making his Formula One debut in Austin that same year before completing a full season in 2018. He would later return to Porsche to prepare the team for their maiden season in Formula E before finally making his home at Giot Dragon Racing. It's an absolute pleasure, no, an honour to have a former Formula One driver, double WEC winner, Le Mans champ, and currently Formula E racer on the show. A huge Motormouth welcome to Brendan Hartley.
Thank you so much for joining us, Brendan, from New Zealand, your home in New Zealand. What's it like over there? It's very early in the morning, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks for the warm welcome as well. It was a bit over the top, but yeah, it's very, I just got up. I probably look like I just got up, although I always look like I just got up. It's the time, 9:10 in the morning, sunny day, but in fact, New Zealand's just overnight gone on to full lockdown as well.
Yes.
So all businesses have just been closed. Can still go outside to exercise, but we're on the other side of the world, but it's a very similar situation.
And presumably you're not based there during a normal race season. This year is obviously a bit weird, but during a normal race season, presumably you don't base yourself in New Zealand, or perhaps you do.
No, really not. My wife Sarah and I were very fortunate. We spent the last couple of years designing and building a house, not with my own two hands, but we built a holiday home here. And that was finished in December, so we had all our friends and family over and put a party here at New Year's. So basically when you know, when all the racing got cancelled over the last month or so, about a week and a half ago, we made the decision just to come back to New Zealand. It was probably the most sensible thing to do. We're not living on top of each other here. We live in Monaco for all the year.
Yeah.
In fact, we normally just come home for Christmas and New Year, so roughly about 1 month per year. But I'm much happier to be here and not living in a small one bedroom apartment right now on lockdown. So I do feel for everyone who is doing that, and we're in touch with a lot of our friends in the south of France. And yeah, I think we made the right call to come home, but it's challenging times for everyone.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Now, you grew up in Palmerston North, an area of New Zealand I've actually never been to.
It's not, as a tourist, you don't normally go through there. But no, there's a racetrack there.
Well, there you go. I was going to say, I mean, how does a young guy from Palmerston North end up getting into racing? So you had a local racetrack, and presumably that's where you first stepped into a kart.
Yeah, so I pretty much grew up at the racetrack even before go-karting. So my father raced pretty much anything you could think of. So Speedway in New Zealand's very popular, so dirt track ovals. He raced minis. He raced Formula Holden, which was a series in Australia, so single seaters. I always used to give Mark Webber stick because he raced against my dad at the, I think it was the very first Melbourne Grand Prix.
Showing his age.
The only bad thing about it, Mark won the race, so there wasn't, you know, the joke could only go so far because Mark won the race. So yeah, he raced from Atlantic. So basically, he raced all sorts, and my earliest childhood memories were watching him race. He was the kind of driver who had a bit of talent, but you know, was just doing it out of the back garage. I remember the stories. One year he bought a Formula Atlantic car that KK Rosberg crashed and destroyed in New Zealand, bought it and spent the whole winter building it up to race it the next year. So you know, that was kind of
wow.
That was how, you know, he was successful in his own right, but never really had the funding or someone to fund him, taking it any further. But yeah, he had a bit of success. So yeah, my earliest memories were being at the racetrack. And I also have an older brother, Nelson, who started go-karting before me. So my father basically gave up his racing to put me and my brother into go-karts, which was actually quite cost-effective back in that time. I know go-karting is...
That's crazy now.
Crazy money in Europe, but at least in New Zealand, it wasn't the case. My father by trade is a, you know, engine builder, and we did everything ourselves, and I would be down at the workshop after school, rebuilding the engine or, you know, putting it on the car. You know, we did everything ourselves, and that was also the theme going into single seaters as well. So, yeah, I was lucky to be in a motorsport mad household.
Yeah, so definitely running through the family blood, yes. Obviously. So, what was the thing in your head that went right? Okay. I want to do this professionally. Motorsport is my out and out passion. And I suppose in New Zealand, how high can you take that before you have to make that inevitable move to Europe or to America, I suppose?
Yeah, it's funny because as a young go-karter, I always told everyone I was going to be a Formula One driver. And I think that's the beauty of being a young seven-year-old. You don't, you know, sky's the limit, right? You know, you dream big and you don't really see all the potential limitations and you know, roadblocks. So looking back, you know, it was probably completely unrealistic for me to believe that would ever happen, but it did.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know it's incredibly cliche, but it's one of those things. Yeah, dreams can come true and do come true.
Yeah.
In my case, it definitely was, but I'm well aware that, you know, there was a bit of luck involved and timing, and I mean, so many people along the way that helped make that happen. But yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, I'm just thinking back. You know, when you're a 5 or 6 year old starting go-karting. I think the thing I enjoyed about it the most was the competitive side of it. Quite quickly, I realized I was quite good at it. I obviously had good equipment because my dad was an engine builder, so we always had good engines and good parts. But I think what really grabbed me in was the competitive side of it. I hated losing, and I loved to win, and it was that competitive element of man and machine working together that, yeah, I just had the bug for. So, you know, every single weekend, maybe not every weekend, but we never went on holidays. Everything we did as a family was going racing.
What was the spirit between you and your brother like? Because you mentioned he was also karting. So what was the competitive nature like between you two?
It's funny because we've never actually raced against each other.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he's 4 years older than me. I tell a lie. And this is something that always stuck with me is I remember my very first go-kart race. I think I just turned six, or maybe I was still five, but I just turned six. And, Dad rolled out this go-kart. I'm sure it wasn't quite as good as my brother's, but I remember the first test day, I obviously was not as quick as my brother, had been doing it for 4 years. And we were racing the next day and we got the carts back to the home. And I remember looking at both carts. Okay, we've got different gears, we've got different NASA. And, I started looking for why his cart was different and why I wasn't fast enough. So what I'm trying to say is that I realized my competitive nature all the way back then.
It's funny, isn't it? It's
just one day I got lapped by my brother. There's no, I was...
Oh, no.
4 years behind, but it was just the fact that I was already looking to how I could gain an advantage, and not just from myself, that man and machine, that combination. So, already from my first weekend, I was, competitive bastard, but also, looking at the machinery and trying to find an excuse here and there.
And you ended up moving to Europe after some success in New Zealand around 16 years old. Who did you come over with, and what can you remember what was going through your head at the time? Were you just thinking, this is amazing, I'm about to live my dream, or were you terrified? I mean, that's a huge leap to make.
Yes, I wouldn't say I was terrified, but I also didn't really know what I was in for. So I guess to give you some perspective, my geography skills were awful. I'd spent, I was a pretty decent student. I was top of my school in maths, scraped through in English, scraped through in history, didn't speak another language. And then at 16 years old, I left school and was traveling across the other side of the world to Europe, to countries I didn't even, hadn't heard of, or couldn't even locate them on the map. And I guess I'm just trying to think where I'm going with this. I was never scared, but when I look back, I'm always kind of surprised that we didn't question it. Even from my parents' point of view, I was 16 years old, and that was, looking back, that must have been a huge decision for them to allow me to hop on a plane. They weren't coming with me. I come from a very, modest family. They couldn't just stop the business and come across the other side of the world. I was off on my own to Europe.
Oh my God.
Never cooking a meal in my life. So I guess at that time, being 16, you tend not to fret and stress about all those potential challenges. It was exciting, but what I wanted to say was that there was never a second thought. I had this opportunity to come up with Red Bull. So I'd been pretty successful in New Zealand motorsport. I had some great support from New Zealand companies and businessmen, helping me in the grassroots in New Zealand. But taking that next step to Europe was in some ways unachievable. Just the level of funding you need to come to Europe was on another planet from what, at least from where I came from. When this Red Bull Junior Team contract turned up, first of all, I'd never seen a contract in my life. So reading it, that was quite daunting, but then the actual decision to leave home, school, friends and family to Europe, it just was never a question. And even for my parents, which I think, I'm trying to consider now, if I had a 15-year-old, would I let them travel to the other side of the world by themselves? And it would be quite a hard question to answer. So, I really appreciate what my parents let me do, but it was so much of a dream and an opportunity for us that it was never a second thought.
I guess they must have seen the the passion that you had for it and thought, this is too good an opportunity to turn down. But it's, like you say, it's a huge thing. I mean, I first went traveling when I was 19 to New Zealand on my own, and I thought that was a major thing to do, and I was kind of surprised my parents let me do that at 19 years old. But to travel to Europe at 16 to pursue your dream, they obviously saw something that in you that they felt was worth pursuing. But nevertheless, a huge move. So when you came over to Europe, where did you settle and who did you settle with? Who were you living with? What did you do for a living arrangement?
So some people will laugh. The people that have been there will laugh. But so I first went to a small town in East Germany called Osterschleben.
Oh, yes.
Do you know it, Harry?
I know Usher Slope. There is a racetrack there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So a small town called Usher Slope, and there's a racetrack there, and that was the team I was racing with. They were based out of that racetrack. So we lived in a little industrial estate about 2 kilometers from the racetrack. I wasn't old enough to have a license to drive a car in Europe, although I was in New Zealand. So we had push bikes. We'd go to the workshop many days of the week, normally to clean tires and do other bits that the team members didn't want to do. You asked who I was living with. I wouldn't call it a house, but you know, we lived basically under power lines, and it was in an industrial estate, so there was businesses around, but we had kind of a room each that we could lock the door to, and there was a shared kitchen. I live with another driver, John Edwards, who is an American driver. He's now professional for BMW. Another Australian driver, Nathan Antunes, and one of the mechanics was living in the complex as well. We had fun. Like, you know, we'd sometimes hop on the train to Berlin on our push bikes and, you know, tear up the city. And, you know, the closest city was Magdeburg. I mean, we had fun, but no one spoke English there. It was all incredibly foreign for me.
Did you pick up any of the local lingo?
That's something I'm a little bit embarrassed about, I have to say, is language was never a strong point for me. I can understand a little bit of German, but I really couldn't hold a conversation. And when I look back and the fact that I did spend quite a bit of time in Germany and even recently being in German teams, I'm a little bit embarrassed that I never took the time to throw myself into learning another language.
I don't think you're alone in that one for anybody.
That's really probably one of my very few regrets, actually. But being a New Zealander, like, I'll never forget being at school and having the option to learn another language and being a, you know, starting high school and teachers telling you, yeah, it'd be good for you to learn another language, French, Italian, German, whatever it was. And I remember just laughing at them, like, no, mate, I'll take music. What do I want to learn another language for? Like, I did not see it back then. No. I seriously, and then a year later, here I am living on the other side of the world. I'm going, oh, crap, you know, maybe that would have been a good idea.
Yeah. you're not the only one, I think. So let's talk about that Red Bull contract that you received, one of the main reasons for you heading over to Europe. How did that come about? And talk us about those early days within the Red Bull program. And because it's come a long way since then, I suppose, and what the structure was like.
Yeah, so when I joined, there was 21, 22 drivers.
Okay, that's still quite a lot, actually, then.
Yeah, it was really a lot. Yeah, I think so. I did the Red Bull Young Driver Search in Estoril. I think it was the same time as Jaime Alguersuari. I remember Sebastian Buemi being there. I think he was already a Red Bull junior. I don't remember the others. Nathan Antunes was signed up on that day. Anyway, so our first Red Bull training camp, which were incredibly fun, in fact, was in Austria. And there was 22 of us. I remember Sebastian Vettel being there and all sorts of others that, you know, that have done well since. And they were fun times, actually, you know, mingling with 22 other young drivers. All, you know, you're friendly with them, but you know that every year there's a turnover of about 10 of us and there'll be another 10 coming next year for the, you know. So it was an interesting dynamic. But, you know, for me, I was meeting all these other drivers from all different stretches of the world, you know, cultures that I'd never experienced before. And it was a fast learning curve for me, just being dumped into different cultures and different environments. And the racing environment was very different too. But I remember that first training camp at Red Bull, and I don't know who organized it, but it must've been a nightmare to organize 22.
And did your hair go down well? Because I've seen some questionable hairstyles from you over the years, especially in some of the older videos.
Yeah, at that time it was probably not as bad. So I went to an all boys school, and we had to have our hair, I think, above the collar and above the ears. So when I left school, I just didn't get a haircut for a while, and it kept growing. And then, you know, people kept saying, oh, you need to cut your hair. And I guess I was just stubborn, you know, I was a stubborn bastard. And I was just like, no, actually, I'm gonna believe it. You know, so over the course of 3 years, it got awfully long. And I look back at those photos now, and I'm like, I mean, I'm embarrassed. I'm like, what was I thinking? But in some ways, it was a bit of stubbornness. But there was a part of me that wasn't stupid, and that I remembered, even if, you know, I would sometimes say, and even if it looks a bit silly, people remember me. And
well,
it was
that's
true.
The thing. You stand out, don't you?
Like, I might have looked like a clown, but people remember me. And there were times in my career, like, oh yeah, I remember you. Yeah, the one with the long hair. I was like, yes, it actually helped.
Yeah.
Set yourself apart somehow. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it wasn't like I said it to myself a few times, but it ended up ringing very true.
Not to think of all the money you'll be saving on haircuts as well that you can
plow
into your racing career. But luckily,
I didn't cut my hair for years. Like,
how long are we talking here? Do you think like over two?
I don't know, a year and a half at least. Yeah, it got pretty long.
But as we said, you know, you're saving all that money from the barber. But as we've touched on already, especially young racers coming up through the field. You need money. You need sponsorships to make the progress and to get to those higher echelons of motorsport. Red Bull program is there for you to help power you up through the junior formulae. You know, you've done Euro Cup Formula, Formula 3, British Formula 3. And then I suppose, is that first big break in 2009 being confirmed as a reserve driver for Red Bull and Toro Rosso in Formula 1? How old were you when that happened?
Was that 18, 19, I think?
That's incredibly young to be, you know, well, I suppose these days you've got Max Verstappen and people like that now, the age has changed, hasn't it? But for that time, that must have been quite a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, I guess I didn't see it at the time. And in some ways, it probably happened all a bit too quickly. I definitely wasn't prepared to be an F1 driver at 18 or 19. And I know Max came in and did it, but you know, hats off to him. I wasn't prepared for it. And just touching on Red Bull, I mean, they, as you say, in motorsport, you need a bit of funding behind you. And I didn't have that from my parents, but I absolutely had that from Red Bull. So they gave me that huge opportunity and so did others in New Zealand, you know, to get myself to where I was, you know, ready to be picked up by Red Bull. But equally I'm still paying back shareholders. I had people that, you know, fellow Kiwis who put money into me, not looking to make a return, but just looking to help out. And I'm still paying them back today because even to be in Europe, even if we weren't paying for the racing, just the living expenses and it's high for a young fellow like me, not having an income and my parents not being able to do it. So I've been incredibly lucky, not only to have Red Bull, but a lot of other supporters and around me to get me through those tricky times. And that is where motorsport is different from a lot of other sports where, there is a certain level of funding and family support, or it doesn't really, you know, a lot of people talk about the, you know, rich kids and, oh, okay, it's daddy's money. But I have a little bit of a different thought on that because, you know, I had Red Bull support, you know, there's still money being spent from somewhere, you know, okay. Mine didn't come from my parents, but you know, I had Red Bull support. I feel incredibly lucky that I had that support and coming through. But yeah, sorry, you mentioned about 2019, and yeah, it happened happened a bit too quickly. So my second year in Europe, I won the Formula Renault 2-liter championship, which back then was, you know, that was the big thing in the up and coming series. It was, I think, 40 cars in the field, and that was a big success. And I think what happened after then, I just moved, everything happened a bit too quickly. So I went to Formula 3 in England. I would argue, you know, I think I maybe had the most wins and the most poles, but I made a lot of stupid errors. That was the year that Jaime Alguersuari won. So we were teammates and I just didn't really put it all together, even if the speed was there. But what happened the year after that was probably I needed another year to kind of grow and figure everything out. But I was then thrown into European Formula 3 with Carling, who didn't have a lot of experience in European Formula 3 at that time. I was thrown into World Series by Renault, the Renault 3.5, the same year. So I think I'm talking 2018 now. Sorry. Yeah, so 2018. So, yeah. So
2008.
Sorry. It is early here, but I have just had
that. No, don't worry.
So let me get my years right here. No, sorry, 2009. 2008 was
right. Okay.
2009. So Formula 3, World Series by Renault, never driven the car before. So that's two championships already. And at the same time, I was made the Formula 1 reserve driver. So I had three calendars and I was, you know, 18 or 19 years old.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, it was too much. I got burnt out. I hated being at the Formula One track. I never really knew my role there. I was sitting in on meetings. And at the same time, the racing wasn't going very well at that year, and it starts to be a bit of a downward spiral. You know, you're doing too much. You're not focused on one thing. You're in the F1 paddock. And that was probably the year which was a bit of a downward spiral, a bit of a dark time. I stopped enjoying it. And, it took a while to recover from that. You know, in 2010, the next year, I lost my drive in the Red Bull Junior program. And I kind of had to find myself again, which was a big thing. I had to go and make my own decisions, pick up the phone, get the whiteboard out, figure out how I turn my career around. Because all of a sudden I was in a situation, I was like, okay, well, I have to make this work now. I'm on the other side of the world. I've got an opportunity to turn it around. And that's another story. But I think, what I'd say is it probably happened a bit too fast, a bit too soon. I wasn't prepared for that level of pressure and busyness. And I'm probably ranting on a bit, but as a 19-year-old, when you're on a plane every single week and just not having time to digest and think, and I just wasn't prepared, mate. So, you know, big respect to the likes of Max Verstappen who was able to do that at 19.
I mean, he's a bit of a freak of nature, isn't he? And I think some other young...
I'm not trying to take anything away from
what he's done. He's been incredible. And there have been some young drivers who have tried to rush into the sport, probably off the back of his success at such a young age. But he is a bit of a once every 10 or 15 years kind of character. But I don't think you're alone in feeling sort of overawed and burnt out by that kind of scenario. And, you know, we see in the F1 paddock, you wander around and you see young drivers coming through, standing in the back of a garage looking lost and thinking, you know, what is my role? What am I doing here? And you do see it.
Oh, it's a simulator as well, mate. Simulator on top of those programs.
It's a lot of responsibility. It's proper sort of sink or swim stuff. But you're not fully developed as a driver or a human being at 19 years old. So it's a very tough scenario. But then what was to come, I doubt you probably even imagined at this stage. But where did the transition happen where you started to look into the LMP route and end up becoming a double WEC champion, Le Mans winner in this sort of few years purple patch that you had? Where did that transition from single seaters move into LMP?
Yeah, so...
Post haircut,
yeah. during 2010 when I lost my drive at Red Bull. So that was, in some ways, it was a bit of a relief. Like a relief. I knew it wasn't going well. I wasn't happy. I'm not saying I wasn't happy with Red Bull. It was just, you know, the situation. Yeah. It was a bit of a downward spiral. So it almost felt like a bit of a new beginning. And I started picking up the phone. I had great advice from a long-time supporter in New Zealand to, look, get the whiteboard out, write down every contact that you have, and just start trying to figure it out. And that's what I did. And during the end of 2010, I picked up a few drives here and there. Same as 2011, I actually was still racing single seaters by, you know, picking up free drives, but, you know, drivers that hadn't paid their bills, so they needed someone last minute. Yeah. And, you know, okay, well, who's out there? Okay, we know Brendan doesn't have any money. We'll throw him in. So had a few drives here and there for that. I'm working like that. And I also went to Mercedes. So during, must have been the end of 2010, I joined Mercedes as their simulator driver.
Yeah.
One of the simulator drivers. There was a couple of us. And I did that for a good couple of years. And I think that was a good move because it kept me, you know, at the high end of motorsport and development and working with a Formula One team in a very professional environment. So I think that was very good for my development. And it was, you know, I was getting a daily wage. You know, that was my wife Sarah was working at a restaurant. I was going every day to the simulator to basically put food on the table. Yeah. And I think that was a good experience for me and also kept me, you know, at the forefront of the technology and development, et cetera. You asked about the endurance. So how that happened was I was still very good friends with Sebastian Buemi.
Yeah.
And I remember he came to Milton Keynes. He was still he was in Formula One at the time, actually, but was just leaving Formula One and had just signed for Toyota and their return to LMP1. And I started asking him about endurance. And it's going to be, you know, I've said it before, and it's probably upset some Le Mans enthusiasts, but I'd never had any interest in Le Mans. I didn't know anything about it. I'd never watched an endurance race before. But here I was chatting to Sebastian about potential opportunities in endurance racing. And I basically followed him to a test at Paul Ricard. I think it was early 2012. I took my helmet and my overalls and a bank account, which I'd saved up a few thousand euros from my work at Mercedes, and speaking to a few teams about getting some laps in an LMP2 car. And that was tough for me, arriving at a racetrack, not knowing anyone. It felt like a new form of motorsport because in endurance racing, back then at least, there wasn't many young single-seater guys trying to do what I was doing. So yes, people knew who I were, but it felt very separate, endurance racing and single-seater racing. Anyway, I walked up and down the pit lane in Paul Ricard. It was the official European Le Mans Series testing. I met every single team owner, and I did 20 laps in an LMP2 car for Boots and Ginian. I paid, I think it was 1,500 euros. Basically a new set of tyres. I did very well on the test. And during that time, I met a funny character called Greg Murphy, an Irish fellow who was running an LMP2 team. He was starting a new team. He actually remembered my stupid long haircut from back then.
Hey, there you go. It's coming in handy.
Winning.
And he liked the idea of putting a young buck from single seaters into his LMP2 car, his team that he was just starting. And I did my very first endurance race about a month later. And you know, that all stemmed from just, you know, arriving at the track with my helmet in hand and meeting every team owner. And
making
that was
happen.
A good lesson for me. And that turned into more races. We finished on the podium. You know, that turned into more endurance races. And a similar story at the end of the year, I met an American fellow called Peter Barron, who met me at Road Atlanta when I was racing LMP2. He put me into his Grand Am car the next season. And I all of a sudden found this new love for motorsport and endurance racing. I never expected to love it so much, but that was true. Like I absolutely loved the racing. I loved the team side of it, the endurance side of it, the getting through the traffic. Loved everything about it. Did my first Le Mans 24-hour in 2012. And in some ways, felt this, like I said, this new love for motorsport.
I was just curious whether your particular style of driving, do you think that suited endurance racing perhaps more than it did single seaters?
I don't know, to be honest.
Did you see yourself having to adapt quite a bit when you got into that endurance car, or was it very much, you know, you're a racing driver, you can race anything?
I think in terms of driving the car, no, because I like to look at a race car quite simply. You know, it's a car, it's got four wheels. The physics behind making the car, look, getting the car as quick around the track as possible is kind of similar with most cars. Mm. You know, obviously wings and slicks, it's very different, but getting the most out of a race car wasn't different. But yes, the style of racing and being patient in the traffic and reading, you know, all those situations is completely different. And that, I wouldn't say I gelled with that straight away. It took me some time. You know, there's a lot to learn in endurance racing. I don't know if my style suited it better, but what I would say is I really enjoyed my time immediately in endurance racing, and I liked all the challenges that went along with it. I think you did ask my journey to Porsche, but what happened there was I sent an email, I think during 2013 to Porsche. I picked up the phone and got a contact from someone. I asked them to look at all my stints during my time in LMP2, and I basically said, I'm the man for the job. And I never even expected a reply, but I almost didn't send the email. And about a month later, I got a reply from Andreas Seidel, who asked me to come and meet him in Stuttgart to discuss being part of their Porsche, their new Porsche LMP1 program. And that opportunity was huge. I had to test to prove my worth, but I guess the timing was unreal. They were looking for someone young who had a little bit of endurance racing experience. I think I ticked a lot of the boxes and they took me on. And that was a huge opportunity there. And that was, I'm going to say that was my first real professional job. You know, in the junior team, I was never really professional. I wasn't getting paid.
Yeah.
Yes, I was a reserve driver. I was standing at the racetracks. But that was my first real professional job where I put on my Porsche overalls. You felt that pressure of being, you know, representing that brand. You had a paycheck coming in. massive professional team that, you know, you were part of trying to get the most out of the technology and development. I mean, yeah, all those things that come along with being a professional, that was the first time I could, truly call myself a professional.
Yeah. And I suppose that first WEC championship, that must have been clearly your first real sense of not only belonging, but also complete euphoria. Tell us a bit about the emotions that you were going through when you took your first WEC championship.
Yeah, I mean, even just, I'll never forget my first Le Mans, not my Le Mans win, but just standing on the grid at Le Mans in the Porsche overalls, looking down the, up and down the grandstand, seeing Porsche flags waving. And that feeling standing on the grid at Le Mans has never been matched. Even my first Formula One race. I mean, a lot of Formula One fans will be shocked by that, but the feeling standing on the grid at Le Mans, representing a brand like Porsche or now Toyota. I haven't raced for Toyota yet at Le Mans, but we don't know when that's going to happen now. It's been delayed.
Yeah.
But yeah, that feeling and that energy on the grid is unrivaled anywhere in the racing world, in my opinion.
It's one of the certainly the top three, isn't it? I mean, I suppose you've got the Monaco Grand Prix, the Indy 500 and the Le Mans 24 hour. It doesn't get any bigger than that. And winning that race must have been just an absolutely astonishing feeling. And then to go on and win the world championship twice, you must have been on cloud nine.
Yeah. And I, you know, not only that, you know, we had so much fun and I'll always look back and cherish those years at Porsche. And the first couple with Mark Webber and Timo, and I learned so much from them, and we had so much fun, and we were really we had such a good team spirit. You know, we were really a team. You know, it wasn't just three drivers driving a car. We were really had that team bond that I don't think many racing drivers will ever experience, particularly not in, you know, if they're only in single seaters. And we're in all the details, and you know, it was just an awesome time and awesome racing, and it was competitive, and it was that's what made me as a driver, to be honest. That learning from being in a car with two professionals in a high pressure environment. I'm kind of lost for words, but it was an awesome time, and that's kind of what took me to the next level as a driver.
Yeah.
After being in such a professional environment with such great teammates, and looking back at it now, realizing that it's kind of over, but it was I'll always look back and with fond memories at that time. Yeah.
Let's just touch on that ending. Obviously, you know, two WC championships and a Le Mans win and Porsche leaving in 2018, 17, sorry. How was the build up to that end, and what were you doing, you know, within yourself to sort of look for the next steps? How do you even begin after having such highs and then having to go, right, I've got to almost start, you know, not start again, but you've got to turn a new leaf in your career?
Yeah, it was, I think we're all a bit shell shocked when we first had the news that Porsche would be pulling out of the LMP1 program. You know, we were all so invested, and as I just said, you know, we were all so happy to be there and you know, enjoying the racing competitive side of it. I'm just trying to remember exactly how it went, but you know, I didn't panic, and I guess it was very similar to early in my career. I picked up the phone, you know, you know, Porsche were not throwing us out the door. You know, they were giving us opportunities to continue as Porsche factory drivers. It wasn't clear what that was going to mean. You know, there was obviously GT. They just announced Formula E, but that's 2 years down the road. And I remember sitting at home and I think it was before the Hungarian Grand Prix 2017. And I remember there was a young driver test after the Hungarian Grand Prix, and it hadn't been announced who Red Bull or Toro Rosso was going to be using. And just had this thought, pick up the phone, you know, like I've had all this experience developing cars at Mercedes and their Formula One program. I've just been involved in Porsche. It was a very high level, you know, it's a very similar environment to Formula One in terms of team structure. So I called Helmut Marko up. I hadn't spoken to him in years actually. And basically told him that if there was ever an opportunity, I was more referring to testing. That's why when I called him up, I said, if there's an opportunity, you know, I'm a different driver than what I was all those years ago, and I'm ready. And it was funny when he didn't say much at the time. I could kind of hear the cogs turning, so to speak. And he just said, okay. And that was pretty much the extent of the conversation. And 2 weeks later, he called me up and asked if I could come to drive the simulator in Milton Keynes. And without asking too many questions, I went and tested the simulator. They put me through quite an extensive program. I'm guessing they were testing me against others that had been in there. I don't know who they were, but I'm sure that was the case. And then another week later, they were talking about putting me in for my first Grand Prix. So, I mean, it really all happened within a number of weeks. And I didn't see it coming. I don't think anyone in the motorsport world saw it coming. And that's really the truth of the story. That's how it happened. Well, there's a bit more to the story too, because I was looking at IndyCar at the time as well. I did kind of leave that bit out. I think during that time I was also meeting with an IndyCar team. I was very close to being in the US. I'd committed myself mentally to driving the ovals and moving to Indianapolis, and then at the very last moment this opportunity to race Formula One came up, and I obviously took it.
And in those,
I think one day I could write a book. There's a lot more to the story, and it
sounds like it needs a book. It needs a book. It's astonishing already just listening to you talk. You get fully invested in this story, don't you? That's absolutely fascinating. And this relationship with Dr. Marco,
the lead up to that first Grand Prix. I mean, I don't want to go into it all now, but that was the craziest month of my life. Like there's probably some things I still can't talk about now, but how it all unfolded and happened and the stress that I was under to try and make that deal work. And it wasn't financially, it was because I had other deals on the table. Yeah, I mean, one day I know my wife actually was writing down, like I was on the, because I was traveling and still racing for Porsche at the time. I was sometimes on the phone till 3 o'clock in the morning looking at contracts. I was on the phone to Helmut Marko at all hours in the morning. And Sarah was actually making notes just because she knew how crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. Whole story was. So I do have some notes there to tell the full story one day, but yeah, it was a crazy
your relationship with Dr. Marco at this point. What is the relationship like there? Do you end up talking a lot? Do you talk every day? Is it intermittent? How does that relationship look?
Well, during that week it was every day, because we were trying to get this it all sorted to race in my first Grand Prix. And you know, this was no more than a week and a half, 2 weeks before the Austin Grand Prix. So we were talking every day to try and figure out all those details. And there was some other contract stuff that I just mentioned before that was incredibly complicated. But yeah, no, I think I always had a mutual respect with Helmut. And, you know, he was tough. In my early career, I'll never forget the feeling I used to get when I'd see the call pop up from Helmut Marko. My heart rate would rise 50 beats, because it was, you know, back then it was never normally a good phone call. And I'll never forget when I won my first race, maybe not my first race, but it was maybe the second or third race. I had Helmut Marko call pop up, and I thought, oh, great, he's going to say congratulations. And the phone call was actually, why didn't you win by more? So that was kind of, you know, he was very hard on us, as young juniors. But I think when I established myself as a professional, you know, he had a very, it was a different relationship, and I always was able to have a good joke with him. And I always respected that he was so straight and transparent.
Yeah.
You know, he meant what he said, which I liked, and that can't be said for everyone in the F1 paddock. You know, there's a lot of others that go through the paddock on their belly, so to speak.
Yeah.
And at least with Helmut, you knew where you stood. And I liked that.
What you saw was what you got with him. Yeah, for sure. I mean, and like you say, I think motorsport's one of those sports where it's very difficult to find people you trust. And when you do meet them along the way, you've got to hang on to them. Let's fast forward then. You've done the race at the USGP in Austin, and a brilliant event, a brilliant place to be. 2018, you get your first full season in Formula One, and I think it's fair to say you had your run of bad luck. I think I read on the F1 website that you hit a bird. You got taken out. You had engine issues, suspension failures. You outpaced your teammate in the first of two or three qualifying sessions, but still got flat from the media.
How did you deal with it in those first few races when questions are already being thrown at you about your future? Where was your mindset going into the middle part of that season?
Yeah, there were some tough moments. As you say, yeah, there were some times that I was unlucky, and the media are looking for a story, right? They're looking. I guess you guys are media too, but that was something that was hard to deal with. I wasn't used to being so much under the microscope, so much in the spotlight. Obviously, you know, professional career at Porsche was different, so to speak. You know, it was more about the brand, more about the car, the team. I have a lot of cherished memories from my time in Formula One. It was always my dream. But there were some tough moments, I'm not going to lie. And there were some defining points there. And like you say, you know, Bahrain was an obvious one where my teammate Pierre, I think he finished fourth. And we had an incredible car that weekend. And that was the funny thing about the midfield battles is, you know, anyone who followed it, sometimes we didn't know why, but every now and then we'd have this incredible car. Maybe it's just how the tyres worked and, you know, got into the window. And Pierre delivered on that weekend. I was 1/10 or so behind him qualifying, but had a crash on the first lap, a drive through. It didn't work out, you know, and those little moments can be defining. You know, he's all of a sudden had a top four. I'm, you know, feeling terrible after the race for not scoring any points. So that, you know, when you've got one season or just a few races to prove yourself, that some of those defining moments can really make a big difference.
Absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, it's fair to say after that, I did have my fair share of bad luck. And look, I don't want to blame all luck or, you know, individual people, whatever it is, but I did have a bit of a bad run. But what I would say is that I was quite, you know, looking back, I was proud on how I brought myself back at the end of the season. We didn't always have a car to score on the points, but I actually got stronger at the end of the season, even under so much pressure.
Yeah.
After four races, I was being asked about rumours about being kicked out of the team. And when you know, I'd just come out of races, you know, out quite from my teammate, whatever it was. And I didn't feel like I was always just, but I had to deal with it. And I felt like by the end of the season, I did learn how to deal with that. And I actually got stronger and stronger. So I learned a lot from that experience. I definitely could have done better at times. I was learning on the way, but ultimately I didn't make it any further. And what I would say is I don't look back and say, oh, I should have been there another season. I should have this, should have that. In the end, I had this very unexpected opportunity to be in Formula One. I have no regrets. I gave it my best shot. There were a few key defining moments. Maybe if I hadn't have made a mistake there, if I was a little bit luckier there, you know, we would have had a better result and the momentum would have been with you. But there's always ifs and buts. And I gave it my best shot. And there are plenty, hundreds of other drivers out there that I know would be worthy of an F1 shot that didn't get one. So I don't look back at it in anger or any regrets. I'm not looking for sympathy. But it's not just the media as well. You know, there's obviously big politics within the team as
sure.
well, which probably not interested to go into, to be honest. But
well, I did read
that not everyone sees what goes on behind the scenes as well. Yeah.
You did allude to that in your article, your sort of farewell to Formula One, sort of stating that perhaps even from as far back as Monaco, you know, despite whatever the rest of the season entailed, you were probably going to be out at the end of the season. What was that about? Can you don't have to expand on that if you don't want to, but is there anything to expand on that?
I don't really feel like going into it. There is politics involved in Formula One.
Of course, yeah.
It's normal. There's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of people. You know, there's even in Toro Rosso, there must have been 500 odd people involved, and egos and people trying to move up and all the rest of that. And it's a complex sport. You know, it's a very complex sport, and it's part of the reason why, you know, we love it as well. It is complicated, but the politics side of it, I didn't always enjoy this.
No, and of course, and that's always going to be the case. But when you look at something like the Red Bull system, you know, at the end of the day, they've given you a massive shot in Formula One. So what do you make of the Red Bull system? Because we alluded to it earlier, you know, there's pay drivers, you know, who've got mummy and daddy's money, but then, you know, there's systems like Red Bull, you've got Mercedes now, you've got Sauber, Ferrari, you've got one as well. these are essentially the same thing. So how do you look at the Red Bull driver program now, you know, with, you know, with your years of experience with it and outside of it?
Well, I mean, I should only speak from my own personal experience, but without that system, I wouldn't be talking to you right now.
Yeah.
I never would have had the opportunity to go and race in Europe. So I think these programs are fantastic for bringing talented drivers through without daddy's money, as you said. But I want to be careful saying that because I don't think it's always fair. You know, you can have a lot of talent even if you're coming from a wealthy family.
Yeah, so completely.
I don't think it's always fair to call out people like that. But yeah, I mean, all I can say is I had my opportunities for the most part due to Red Bull. So I can only thank them for that. And I'm sure there's plenty of other drivers out there that will tell you the same. So I think we're very lucky in motorsport to have such programs to breed talent and bring them through.
Now, Brendan, before we touch on your Formula E exploits, we have a very important quiz for you to test your knowledge. Now, there is a leaderboard here. There are people on it. We were expecting big things. And I think Harry's been pretty kind with these questions. So I'm expecting you to be up the leaderboard.
What topic, mate? I'm getting nervous now.
Don't be nervous.
I don't watch a lot of motorsport in my free time, mate. I steer clear of it. So
well, you're lucky because these are all to do with you. So hopefully... this is our Motormouth quiz, notoriously the hardest motorsport quiz in the world. There's a maximum of 4 points up for grabs. I've got four clips for you.
Four questions.
And basically, we're going to play you four clips. And after each one, basically, I just want you to listen and then tell me what you think is happening or what happens next. So we'll start with clip number one.
Mate, is he going to let me fly? What the f*** is going on? Mate, he's holding me on so much.
Beat me out as well, mate. No, I know exactly what that was. Yeah,
go on then. What's happening there?
That was... In Brazil, when I was told my teammate was going to let me by, so I wasn't attacking him, and for like four or five laps he didn't let me by, and I was just getting a bit annoyed because
one point for you. Yeah.
Let's move to clip number two.
Here it comes.
Now for this one, I want you to think about where this is happening.
Okay,
here we go.
Brendan, are you okay?
Yep, suspension failure.
That was Silverstone, mate. I remember that one well too. Happened quick. Yeah,
I saw watching the replay of the crash. It's very akin to, I don't know if you remember the one of course your mate Sebastian Buemi in the Toro Rosso back in China, where both his wheels came off.
I shouldn't say this, but if every now and then I bring that video out, like we have a little group chat with the Toyota drivers, and because I just find it hilarious. I know it was terrible what happened, and it could have been worse, but. You can see him trying to steer the thing like a boat. You know, like he's got no front wheels. And he's trying to steer it out of the water. Always makes me laugh. He still doesn't really laugh about it, which is great. So if you want to give him a...
We'll definitely bring that up.
We'll bring that one up, yeah, for sure. All right, well, that's two out of four so far. You're doing well. Let's move on to clip number three.
Here it comes.
And he's got tangled up with Lance Stroll!
Yeah, what happened there?
Well... Yeah, was it like three or four weekends in a row I had massive shunts, and that was just one of them. So, I was on the outside of Lance in Canada. I don't remember the corner.
Yep.
I don't know the name of the corner, but I still don't know if he actually had a puncture, because I heard there were kind of – some people said he had a puncture, some people didn't. That was a big crash too, mate. I had a headache. And
no, really?
Yeah, big headache after that one.
It didn't
look as bad as the Silverstone one, but that one hurt more.
Yeah. Well, if it's any consolation, you get a point.
This is looking good.
I must get another point for the most big crashes in a Formula One season.
That's a fair comment. this one is not crash related. Here it comes.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, we're punching above our weight. 4.5 million people. Other side of the world, don't forget. I don't know. I get asked a lot. I mean, actually, 2012, when I first competed in Le Mans.
So what are you talking about there? Any ideas?
What am I talking about?
Yeah.
My wife's in the other room listening, so I said punching above my weight. I might have been talking about
Go on, Mrs. Hartley.
No, I guess I was just chatting about all the Kiwis in New Zealand motorsport. I think that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah.
So you've got 4 out of 4 there. Well done. That takes you to the top of the leaderboard. But actually, at the moment, that means you're tied with 3 others. That's Ollie Webb.
They weren't very hard, but yeah.
The opportunity to go top.
We've got a bonus question now. Can you tell me, for a bonus point, what year Red Bull first joined Formula One and who were their drivers?
So, because they were first with together with Sauber, so you're meaning as a...
Okay, so as a fully-fledged team.
Okay, so I'm just trying to think of the year. So it was Mark Webber and... No.
It's tense. Any ideas?
It's tense.
Oh.
But Red Bull took over Jaguar, right?
Yes. Tim, get your stats up.
But hold on. So I'm just thinking about this.
Yeah.
First year. Oh God. Yeah, I'm not going to get the bonus point then.
Oh no.
Because
if I give you one of the drivers,
it's really bad. I was about to say David Coulthard and Mark Webber. So that's really bad.
Well, one of them is that you're halfway there.
Yeah.
One of those drivers is correct. So you got DC. Okay.
So DC.
It's with all respect to the driver, it's a left field driver. It's not the first one that comes to your mind.
No. I think that's half a point.
Half a point.
We need an out.
Who was the other driver? Christian Kleen. Yeah, you know what? Now you said it. Yeah.
Yeah. Any more idea on the year?
Oh, the year. I don't know. 2004?
You're one out. 2005.
Okay.
But I'm going to give you half a bonus point for getting David Coulthard. So that takes you, Brendan Hartley, to the top of the Motor Mouth leaderboard with 4.5 points.
I'm going to give you some more applause.
A small applause.
This beats your double world championship winning WEC business.
I'm sure it does.
On the TV, yeah.
Let's bring it back to Formula E. This is a topic of discussion that we often have on this podcast about Formula E, the merits of it, how good it is, how good it isn't, what people like about it, what they don't. And it is polarizing. How are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I'd say I'd be enjoying it a lot more if I had more success, which hasn't really gone very well so far. You know, as you can imagine, when you're doing well, it's you're loving life. When you're spraying champagne, it's easier to enjoy it. But no, I do enjoy it. You know, it's incredibly competitive, not only from the drivers but also the teams. I mean, I can't think of any other series out there that has so many manufacturers, you know, fully, you know, OEM manufacturers involved and supporting the championship. And I think some of the racing style with managing energy, there's it's very complex, but also it creates great racing. But yeah, it's tough, you know, like it's been a tough entry for me and you know, Dragon, Geox Dragon are really like the team. But we are a smaller team. And I think, you know, no one's hiding the fact that I think we're definitely the smallest team we're creating our own drivetrain and we have a lot less staff than the likes of these big manufacturers, but we still believe that we can, you know, hopefully challenge a bit when we do get racing again. But so far it hasn't gone to plan, you know. I think what we do have on our side, and being in a small team without the same restrictions of being manufactured, you can be a bit more dynamic. But yeah, hopefully now that we actually have a couple of months up our sleeve to work, we have all these great ideas, but not enough man hours and time to implement them. So hopefully with a couple of months up our sleeve, we might be able to fight back. But I enjoy it. It's, you know, a lot of people worry about electric cars not being exciting to drive. And my argument there is, once you get used to the fact that there's no engine noise, an electric motor is incredibly exciting to drive. It's very direct. Sitting in the car, you feel more at one with the drivetrain than you do in a combustion engine car. And the way I'd explain that is that you have a more of a direct link from the throttle to the accelerator. You know, there's no lag. You have instant torque, instant power. So you have this very direct link from what you're doing on the throttle pedal to the electric engine. Another thing I'd say is you take away that sound, but you all of a sudden get all these other cues that you've never had before. You can hear the tires screeching. You can hear the car bottoming out. You hear this wind noise. So you become more in tune with other cues that you haven't experienced before. So it's definitely. Oh, and one other thing to mention: we have a lot more power than we have grip. So there's no issues there. We are fighting those cards, but no, I think it's exciting, and I think what it does do is it displays and advertises electric racing, electric vehicles, in an exciting manner. You know, I think it wasn't that long ago when everyone saw electric vehicles as very boring, and I think that's changed in a very short amount of time. And as has the technology and development of the cars in a very short amount of time. I'm sure that's going to be no different in the next years.
It's great. I mean, my opinion of it has changed. I mean, I've said for a long time when it first came out, I wasn't the biggest fan, but I'm certainly warming to it. And we spoke to Ollie Webb not long ago, who's had the opportunity to drive in a couple of Formula E cars, and he absolutely loved it. He was waxing lyrical about it. Couldn't get enough of it. So I think as a driving experience, it sounds utterly amazing. And you know, they've done incredibly well to get it to where it is. And you know, whether it's the future or it's a passing phase or, you know, whatever it ends up being, I think it provides exciting wheel to wheel racing, and that's what everybody wants to see.
Yeah, and what I didn't even mention was the fact that we're driving in the heart of city centres that never seen motorsport before, on arguably some of the most difficult tracks we've ever seen before. So there's that element too. You know, the series has been able to take electric racing to places that it's never been. Sorry, racing in general to places it's never been before. So that part of it also is exciting. Like I said, if I was sitting here after spraying a bit of champagne and having a bit more success, it would be a different story. It has been tough, I'm not going to lie, but I'm remaining positive that as a team and we can, you know, maybe still turn it around.
We'll touch
wood. Fingers crossed when and if we get back racing this year, it will be an upward incline. Do you have a hero, racing or otherwise?
Say no is a short answer, but as a young fella, for reasons I still don't fully know why, but I was a massive John O'Lacey fan as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, so
I think he was sporting the same number as me at the time, which was 28. It was a young go-karter, so I was a Ferrari fan, and I think I was always, you know, I supported the underdog. You know, there was, you know, Schumacher always winning the races, and I was supporting John O'Lacey. So I was a huge John O'Lacey fan, and I've actually, you know, met him a few times in the paddock, and it was quite funny as meeting him when. You know, it's very different. It's funny meeting someone when he was kind of a childhood hero, so to speak. But, you know, in terms of racing, I wouldn't say I have a hero. I've got obviously a lot of people I look up to and admire, and fellow competitors that I have respect for. But as a young fella, I supported John O'Lacey and had the Ferrari flag on my wall.
I think that's a good shout. I'm with you on John O'Lacey. Okay, what are you rubbish at?
Oh, dancing.
Ooh. Not going to see you on Strictly Come football. Dancing football. Okay. Ah, another.
I'm not bad. Football. I'm not bad with like, you know, with the hands, like throwing a ball, juggling, all that kind of stuff. But with the feet, I never really played football.
Fair enough. But well, do you have any talents that perhaps the public aren't aware of?
I think it's
going
to be guitar.
Unusual quirks.
Unusual quirks. I fancy myself on the mountain bike. I mean, that's. I love riding my mountain bike. I'm not going to say I'm world class, but I guess I can surprise a few people on two wheels. I actually, since we've been in lockdown, I just bought a guitar, ordered it in. So I've just started playing the guitar again. I'm not particularly good, but I do enjoy playing it.
Well, now it's time to learn.
One hidden talent that was quite funny, almost I didn't know I had it either, was we had a Toyota training camp with all the drivers and upper management. Two months ago in Austria. So it was a winter training camp. So I've never really skied in my life before. I've never, you know, haven't done a lot of the winter stuff because I'm basically chasing the sun. I come home for summer and over Christmas, and I go back to Europe for summer during the racing season. But on one of the days we went to play ice hockey. So I kind of, I told everyone, look, I've never really been ice skating before. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. I hopped on the ice and, yeah, it was a bit of a hidden talent. So
hidden even to you.
I used to play roller hockey as a young fella.
What's that?
I used to play
it's
this.
Ice hockey, but on rollerblades.
Oh, okay.
So
incredible.
I played for about 4 or 5 years, I didn't tell anyone at Twitter this, so don't mention it. I actually represented my local town, and I was decent, but I kind of didn't realize 20 years later, hopping on ice, that it was all going to come back. And I think I really pissed all the other drivers off because everyone's kind of struggling just to stand up or even hit the puck. And here I was doing slap shots and flicking in the top corner. And so that was a bit of a hidden talent that I actually got a bit of a bug for it. I'd love to hop back on the ice, but it's not an easy thing to...
There's a video coming here. I can see it, Harry, already. So when I was about, how old would I have been? I don't know, 20 something. And weirdly, tenuous links here. My brother, who's a Kiwi, he was over in the UK one of the few times that he came over here, and he came to watch me play roller hockey because I used to play a lot.
Oh, you used to play as well?
Yeah, okay. I played for a team called the Beverly Bandits. And I was one of the youngest guys to ever represent them. I got picked for Great Britain and then quit. I just stopped playing. But he came over to watch me play, and I loved it. And the same as you, I could jump on the ice tomorrow and be absolutely fine and totally confident. I can just, this is it. Harry, this is it. We're doing a video. Brendan Hartley, we're going rollerblading. Well, so it's all going to happen.
I've potentially oversold my abilities, but
I do that all the time.
I was nervous about going onto ice skates, but then quickly I realized it wasn't so different from the rollerblades. But I absolutely loved it. Like I was trying to figure out where I could actually go and, hop on the ice and, hit a puck around somewhere. But it's not easy to actually find that unless you live in Canada or...
No, true, true. But rollerblading is great for your fitness. Get out. Oh, you can't. Oh, you could do that. Even in lockdown, you could go out rollerblading around the countryside. Right, Harry, I think it's probably time for our final four.
Yes, actually, before we do the final four questions, I had one question that I just wanted to... I didn't get the chance to go in earlier, but it was when you touched on your simulator driving with Mercedes. When you were going in every day, were there signs of what was to come at Mercedes and the World Championship years?
100%, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the team was incredibly motivated. Even myself as a sim driver was doing long hours, and you could just see, you could see how motivated and how much they were pushing. And I had a really good feeling there. I enjoyed my time at Mercedes, and I'm sure a lot of the guys I was working with are still there today. So
yeah.
Yeah, I always had the feeling that they were coming. Yeah, since I left, they've been very dominant. Yeah, I don't know if there's a
You laid the foundations.
Yes.
okay, so we have a final four questions that we ask everybody who comes on. So I'll kick things off. What's got you excited at the moment?
Playing my guitar again, because I'm not very good, but I want to learn a few new songs.
Yeah. And, yeah.
If you weren't a racing driver, what would you be doing?
I really have no clue. I guess if you consider that it's what I've done all my life and I even left 16, I have no idea. I mean, at this point, it's probably going to be something to do with racing because that's all I know.
Let's go hairdresser.
Hairdressing.
I wouldn't get to work.
How much of your success is about luck? How much is about hard work?
I'm going to say 75%, a bit of luck and right time. But at that same time, you've got to make the most of those opportunities when they do come up. So I guess that's the other 20%. So yeah, I'm very aware of being in the right place at the right time, but also it does require you, like you say, requires you kind of getting that luck. I wouldn't say picking up the phone's hard work, but it is also about making those opportunities and trying to find them as well.
Final question for you, Brendan, and then we'll let you have your breakfast. What are you scared of?
Spiders.
Yeah.
Oh, that's another one. A lot of people. It's spiders.
I don't mind them.
Well, depending on the spiders, mate, I'm not that scared. But
you don't want to be near it.
I'm like, yeah, you get the spider.
And I'll get some big spiders out there.
No, not really.
That's you know what you do get out there.
That's probably why I'm scared. When you go to Australia and you see these big huntsmen, it's funny. Like people that haven't been to New Zealand think it's there's going to be snakes and crocodiles, and I mean, we've got nothing that'll hurt you.
Well, that brings us to the end.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating to hear your story. You 100% must write a book. Honestly, it's been a real pleasure getting you on here. Thank you for taking the time out of your day. Stay safe. safe out there. We hope this all blows over quickly and we see you back on a racetrack soon. But huge thanks from both Harry and I and all our listeners, and we will see you in a paddock soon.
Cheers, guys. Have a good one.
Thank you so much for listening and giving up your time for us. We'll be back with another episode soon. If you've missed any of the previous episodes, you can take a hop back in your chosen podcast player and find them all there. And don't forget, there's also loads more content on MMTV and the Motormouth app available to download on any device now. And to continue to allow us to help create lots of cool content and to keep making these podcasts, we wanted to let you know about our new Patreon program and how you can join. It just starts from £5 a month to 10 or 20. Each tier allows you slightly different levels of access depending on which one you choose. You can enjoy early access to podcast episodes, exclusive member benefits, merchandise, shout outs, and your chance to feature on one of our shows. Any support you can give us is massively appreciated and will help us grow and continue to bring cool content to race fans all over the world. Just search for us on patreon.com, or you can find out all the details across our socials. On Twitter, it's @Motormouth_, Instagram @Motormouth_official, and on Facebook, just search Motormouth. Like, subscribe and review if you feel so inclined as well. It really helps people to find the podcast. But in the meantime, from myself and Tim, we'll catch you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.